and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes we'll be featuring articles from the Washington Post, from Religion and Politics, from Religion News Service, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and unless otherwise noted, all articles are read as printed. Don't forget that podcast editions of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available on our website at ncreadingservice.org. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an article published on March 2nd in the Washington Post. And the headline of this article, Christians around the globe take up fasting for Ukraine on Ash Wednesday. And this article is by Sarah Pulliam Bailey of the Washington Post. Pope Francis and other Christian leaders around the globe have encouraged believers to fast and pray for Ukrainians on Ash Wednesday, a day when many Christians are reminded of their mortality with a swipe of ashes to their foreheads. The last 2 years have led clergy scrambling to find ways to distribute ashes safely during the pandemic. This year, Christian leaders' attention has turned to the recent attacks from Russia on Ukraine, with calls for prayers for peace. May the Queen of Peace preserve the world from the madness of war, Pope Francis wrote in his call for fasting. The ancient Christian practice of fasting allows believers to heighten their senses and focus their spiritual energies, said the Reverend Mark Morozowicz, a theologian at the Catholic University of America. He said that Ukrainian Catholics like him began Lent on Monday, unlike Roman Catholics who began on Wednesday, but different groups of Christians will be engaged in similar spiritual acts during the Lenten period. The world is called to deeper prayer, said Morozowicz, who is dean of CU's School of Theology and Religious Studies. As we continue to stand by our Ukrainian brothers and sisters, and as the world shows to Russian authorities that this is intolerable, we have the chance to try to build a world that's built on mutual respect and order, not based on tyranny and fear, one that is built on respect and love for our fellow human beings. For Christians who observe Lent, including President Biden, who is Catholic, Ash Wednesday marks the beginning of the period of weeks leading up to Easter Sunday, which most Christians in the United States will celebrate on April 17th. The weeks of Lent serve as a period of reflection on the biblical story of Jesus' time in the desert, where he fasted and prayed before his death and resurrection. Although most Americans who celebrate Lent began on Wednesday, the majorities of people living in Russia and Ukraine belong to Orthodox Christian wings of Christianity, most of whom will begin Lent on March 7th and end on the day they celebrate Easter, April 24th. During Lent, many Catholics and some Protestants give up something during the period and do forms of fasting, such as refraining from eating meat. Many groups are holding prayer services specifically on behalf of Ukrainians this year. For example, on Wednesday, Catholic University's Ukrainian Church Studies Center held a day-long prayer vigil in the Basilica of the National Shrine's Byzantine Chapel in Washington. Though fasting is not obligatory for Ukrainian Catholics as it is for Roman Catholics, the Reverend Robert Hitchens, pastor of the Ukrainian Catholic National Shrine of the Holy Family in northeast Washington, D.C., said he has encouraged his congregation to participate in the global fast on Wednesday. Everyone is worked up and on pins and needles, Hitchens said of members of his congregation. With Lent coming, it's time for intensified prayer and doing good works. It's a way for people to do something concretely. Other Christian leaders also called for prayer on Ash Wednesday on behalf of Ukrainians. Five Christian World Communions, including the World Communion of Reformed Churches, the Lutheran World Federation, and the Mennonite World Conference, held a joint Ash Wednesday prayer service for peace in Ukraine. And several people said that they plan to fast on Wednesday even though they don't belong to the Roman Catholic Church. Dan Gibson, who is part of the Anglican Church of North America and would not typically follow Pope Francis's direction, said that he felt like fasting on Ash Wednesday was an ecumenical moment for Christians worldwide after he saw Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby, the spiritual leader of Anglicans worldwide, join Francis's call. I'm a lawyer, not a soldier, not a paramedic. I'm not a person who can go over to Ukraine and do much to help anyone, said Gibson, who lives in Durham, North Carolina. As a Christian, I believe God listens to our prayers. This is at least something I can do. Though she left the Catholic Church of her youth, Patricia Yingst, who now describes herself as spiritual, saw Pope Francis's call to fast and planned to join him. I wish I could hug a Ukrainian right now. All I can do is meditate and pray at the moment, said Yingst, who is based in Oroville, California. Fasting is something I know I can accomplish to be supportive of people trying to make a difference. It seems like a little thing, but I'm doing what I can. Hoping to show solidarity with the people of Ukraine, Jared Cook said that even though his denomination, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, doesn't observe Lent or Ash Wednesday, he plans to join others who are fasting. LDS members typically fast during one Sunday of each month and are asked to give the money they would have spent on food to the LDS church, which then distributes it to people in need. Cook said he felt like he didn't need to wait for LDS leadership to call for a fast for Ukrainians. Scrolling Twitter, watching the updates of what's happening in Ukraine, your heart goes out to these people, seeing as how they're defending themselves, said Cook, who is an attorney in Rochester, New York. There's a sense of helplessness that comes with that. It's not like I can show up in person and pick up a gun and help them. Christians have historically fasted for all kinds of reasons, and Ash Wednesday reminds people of their own mortality and lack of control, said Tyler Wiggs Stevenson, an Anglican priest in Toronto who has done activism opposing the use of nuclear weapons. It's interesting to think people are latching on to fasting as a way to give them agency, he said. But it's the spiritual move Christians have always made. Here's this war we can't control, but we're going to acknowledge our dependence on a higher power. In the biblical story of Jonah, when the prophet warns Nineveh of impending destruction because of its wickedness, the city turned to fasting and prayer, and God decided not to destroy the city. Fasting engenders weakness, Wiggs Stevenson said, and it brings home how dependent and vulnerable people are. When you think about fasting, especially toward an end rather than for self-improvement, it's not about your own agency, but a recognition of your dependency on God. We fast and repent because it's our way of drawing close to the reality of death for us, he said. After we fast, you become desperate for food. It's a way of appealing to the hope of life that defeats death. It feels appropriate to do that in the face of a war. We appeal to the Lord of life, to the one who can offer resurrection in the face of death. Our next article this week on Religion in the News is an essay from the journal Religion and Politics entitled, What Does the Russian Invasion Mean for Religious Minorities in Ukraine? This article is by Anna Piella and was published on March 1st in Religion and Politics. Last week, the Washington Post obtained a letter from the U.S. to the United Nations warning of further Russian human rights abuses against vulnerable groups in Ukraine, including religious minorities. While the letter did not specify which religious groups would be targeted, it alleged that Russian forces are creating lists of identified Ukrainians to be killed or sent to camps following a military occupation. By far, the majority religious tradition in Ukraine is Orthodox Christianity, 78% of the population, according to a 2017 Pew report. Religious minorities include Greek Catholics, 10%, Protestant Christians, 1-2.5%, as well as Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, Roman Catholics, and pagans. There is also a small number of Jehovah's Witnesses and Latter-day Saints. More than 13% of the illegally annexed Crimea is composed of Tatar Muslims. As the long shadow of Russia falls on Ukraine, these religious minorities are among those who are most at risk if Russia's military campaign succeeds. For many in Central and Eastern Europe, this Russian hit list may evoke the terrifying stories of the NKVD, the Soviet security forces, banging on the door at night to take family members away, never to be seen again. Only after the collapse of the Soviet Union were many people able to access documentation regarding the death of their relatives in prisons, labor camps, or at mass execution sites. That trauma is still powerful in many Eastern European families. My own Polish great-grandfather was taken away in 1945 to perish, as we later found out, in a prison where he was placed on unspecified charges, most likely related to his visits to France in the pre-war period. Those who belong to one of the groups listed in the U.S. letter must be reading it with utmost anxiety. Ukraine legally guarantees the freedom of religion in its constitution, though religion in the country is not without tension. The country's Orthodox Christian majority is largely split between two factions. In 2018, the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, or OCU, formed, with its leadership in Kyiv, and independent recognition followed from the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople. The OCU formation only deepened the split with the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, or UOC, which is under the authority of the Patriarch of Moscow. Both factions in Ukraine have condemned Russia's invasion. Moreover, for religious minorities, there are many reports of local authorities denying religious minorities permits to even build houses of worship. The nation's legacy of anti-Semitism also continues, even under a Jewish president and prime minister, as Jewish-owned buildings are still frequently vandalized. Tatar Muslims also continue to face discrimination. Some scholars argue that the rise in religious nationalism in Ukraine has contributed to a decrease in religious tolerance. Others, like Mikhailo Yakubovich, a postdoctoral researcher at Freiburg University in Germany and an associate professor of religious studies at the National University of Austro-Academy in Ukraine, say that the situation of religious minorities has improved. He wrote to me via Facebook Messenger to say, "In contrast to many other post-Soviet states, as well as some Central European countries like Hungary or Poland, Ukraine made substantial progress on protecting religious minorities." He also commented that the tension between the nation's Orthodox factions, the OCU and the UOC, is political rather than strictly religious. His opinion is aligned with that of Metropolitan Epiphanius, the leader of the OCU, who wrote in a recent statement, "Ukraine is proud of interfaith and interethnic peace. No matter how hard the Kremlin tried to inflame the pro-Russian opposition over the years, it failed." While we can't predict the future, the past can be a good indicator of how Russia handles religious minorities. In 2017, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom listed Russia as a country of particular concern for creating an increasingly repressive environment for religious minorities. While Ukraine's approach may not be ideal, it is legally framed in a way that has much more in common with how minorities are treated in the West. The constitutionally guaranteed freedom of religion is central to the existence of religious diversity. In the Russia-controlled areas of Donetsk and Luhansk, the authorities have continued to exert pressure on minority religious groups. They are now required to re-register under harsh Russian law that discourages or prevents recognition of many religious minorities. Many of them refuse to re-register, thereby losing the legal status and protection they enjoyed under Ukrainian law. Strikingly, among these groups is also the OCU, the newly formed Ukrainian Orthodox Church, labeled by the Moscow Patriarchate as schismatic. Russia's capture of Crimea is also illustrative of what could happen now in Ukraine. In the summer of 2003, I stood on the shores of the Kerch Strait at the easternmost tip of the Crimean Peninsula, looking across the water at the shimmering Caucasus Mountains on the Russian side. At the time, the Kerch Strait was not only a boundary between Europe and Asia, but also a still undisputed border between Ukraine and Russia. In the same year, a bilateral agreement signed between the two countries guaranteed each other's freedom of navigation in the Kerch Strait. As such, that place was not only a border between two continents, but also a meeting place of two countries. That summer, I was on a backpacking trip to Ukraine, my native Poland's geopolitical neighbor, with my college friends. Empires had come and gone in Ukraine, and they all left behind cultural sediment, tombs, places of worship, and inscriptions on walls. We took a train to Odessa, the gateway city to the Crimean Peninsula, itself an important site connecting Europe to the Silk Road, with monuments of the ancient Scythian cultures, the Khazar Khanate, the Byzantine, Mongol, and Ottoman empires. Historical and cultural sites that were particularly attractive to me were connected to religious traditions I would later study and teach, Islam and Judaism. Like in the rest of the country, hospitality was clearly helping many locals in Crimea get by economically. In the rented rooms where we stayed, we talked to our Tatar and Uzbek Muslim hosts in a mix of Polish, Russian, and broken Ukrainian about our commonalities and differences. Now such a trip could never take place. After the 2014 illegal annexation of the Crimean Peninsula by Russia, foreign tourism has all but disappeared from Crimea, a once popular destination given its ancient monuments and the Black Sea beaches, leaving its economy severely weakened. After the intensification of fighting in eastern Ukraine, and now the entire country, the situation in annexed Crimea has largely faded from political debate in the West, but it remains a stark warning for what might be about to happen to the rest of Ukraine. The tip-off about the impending persecution of Ukrainian religious minorities in the U.S. letter is plausible, given the Russian authorities' hostile treatment of the Tatar Muslim minority in eastern Ukraine and in annexed Crimea. Muslims have been subject to surveillance, harassment, intimidation, threats, intrusive and unlawful searches of their homes, physical attacks, and forced disappearances. The Mihailis, the highest self-governing body of the Crimean Tatars, was forcibly disbanded in 2016 amid an unfounded allegation of extremism. Historically, Tatar Muslims have had reason to fear Russian annexation, as they have long been averse to Russian rule. After the first Russian annexation of Crimea in 1783, 300,000 Tatars emigrated to the Ottoman Empire. Under Stalin's rule in May 1944, the entire Tatar Muslim ethnic group was deported from Crimea to Central Asia on charges of national treason, as some Tatars collaborated with the Nazis. The rounding up of the 200,000 people, men, women, children, and the elderly, took 3 days. Their homes and belongings were confiscated by the Soviet state. Historians estimate that between 18% and 45% of those 200,000 died in exile due to starvation, forced labor, diseases, and cold. Only in 1989, under Gorbachev, were the Tatars legally allowed to return to Crimea, but the process of their reassimilation has been painfully slow, and they were not granted fair reparations. Likewise, the history of Judaism in what is now Ukraine is more than 1,000 years old and overshadowed by persecution and threats of pogroms and exile. And yet, at times, the Jewish communities in Ukraine have flourished. Hasidism, an important mystical current of Judaism, was born in what was then known as the Pale of Settlement, a stretch of land between modern-day Lithuania and Romania. After the genocide of World War II, the surviving Jewish population in Ukraine gradually declined, with many Ukrainian Jews emigrating to Israel and the United States. While anti-Semitism has remained a problem in Ukraine, there is now a legal ban on anti-Semitic behaviors in the country. However, political upheavals have always been dangerous for Jewish communities in Eastern Europe. They've caused intergenerational trauma in Ukrainian Jews, who are sensing a shadow of anti-Semitic violence looming over their community now. An Odessa rabbi recently bought enough canned goods to last the entire year and hired Israeli security guards. Many Ukrainian Jews have already evacuated to Israel. There is no space for democracy or religious minorities in the Russian vision of Ukraine as a country that is essentially the same as Russia. They will be seen as a threat to a manufactured, ultimately controllable homogeneity. As democracy is at grave risk in Ukraine right now, minorities are likely to be the first to feel the brunt of Russian repressions, heralded by the persecution of Tatar Muslims in Crimea and eastern Ukraine. The protection of the rights of religious minorities is often the litmus test for democracy. It is a test that the region cannot fail without dire consequences. Our next article comes to us from Religion News Service, published on March 1st. And this article is entitled, SBC President Ed Litton Won't Run Again, to focus on racial reconciliation instead. The subheadline, Litton will become the first SBC president in 4 decades to not seek re-election after his first 1-year term. This article is by Bob Smetana of Religion News Service. Saying he wants to spend his time focusing on racial reconciliation, Southern Baptist Convention President Ed Litton announced via video Tuesday, March 1st, that he would not seek a second term in office. Litton will become the first SBC president in 4 decades to not seek re-election after his first 1-year term. The last SBC president to do so was famed Memphis, Tennessee megachurch pastor and radio preacher Adrian Rogers. A pastor from Mobile, Alabama, Litton was elected in June 2021 by a few hundred votes, narrowly defeating Georgia pastor Mike Stone, who is a member of the Conservative Baptist Network, a group that believes the nation's largest Protestant denomination has become too liberal. In his video, Litton highlighted some of the disaster relief work Southern Baptists have done this past year, including after the wildfire in Colorado and the tornadoes in Kentucky, as well as ministry done by Baptist churches at the southern border of the United States. He also outlined plans for what he called gospel-centered racial reconciliation, based on a program Litton had been part of in Mobile, where he is pastor of Redemption Church. As part of that work, Litton met regularly with pastors from different ethnic groups in Mobile, and they worked together on issues of race in their community. Litton said he hopes to introduce a national version of the approach taken in Mobile that can be embraced by Southern Baptists, calling it a very simple strategy to pursue this kind of work that will bridge the racial divides throughout our communities throughout North America and bring about a gospel-centered racial reconciliation. I believe this work is something God is calling me to do and to devote myself to for the next 5 to 10 years of my life, he said. But I also believe that at this important moment in the life of our convention, it is best for me to do so as a pastor and not from the office of president of the Southern Baptist Convention. The announcement came 2 days after the SBC marked Racial Reconciliation Sunday, an annual event first introduced in the 1960s. Social media postings about the annual event were criticized over the weekend as a sign of liberalism. On its website, the CBN denounced a recent online event focused on racial reconciliation in the SBC because the event, featuring Lytton and New Orleans pastor Fred Luter, the first black president of the SBC, along with other speakers, but did not include Memphis theology professor Lee Brand, the current first vice president of the SBC. Brand is black. Southern Baptists are asking how they can take seriously claims that current SBC leadership genuinely seeks racial unity when they decline to include in racial unity discussions the current first vice president of the Southern Baptist Convention, read a statement on the CBN website. Leaders of the CBN and other critics of current SBC leaders have also repeatedly said that the denomination is becoming woke and that Baptist leaders have embraced critical race theory, a term for legal theories about structural racism that has become a rallying cry for political conservatives. Lytton's first 8 months in office were marked by controversy in the SBC. Members of the denomination's executive committee, which oversees the SBC's operations between annual meetings, feuded over how to proceed with a sex abuse investigation, a controversy that ended with more than a dozen members of the committee resigning last fall. Not long after his election, critics of Lytton discovered he had plagiarized parts of several sermons from J.D. Greer, his predecessor as SBC president, a controversy that became known as Sermongate. Lytton said that Greer, a friend, had given him permission to use parts of his sermons, but that Lytton did not give Greer, a North Carolina megachurch pastor, credit, nor did he tell his congregation that parts of the sermons came from Greer. Lytton later apologized for failing to give credit. He alluded to Sermongate, which set off a heated discussion about plagiarism in sermons in Tuesday's video, as well as some of the other struggles the SBC has faced in recent months. "It's no secret that this has been a difficult year," Lytton said in his video. "As we fought to emerge from 2 years of pandemic, many of our pastors and churches are struggling. We've also navigated some painful conflicts and intense discussions right now. And I want to speak as plainly as I can. As I have previously stated, I take responsibility for my own failures and shortcomings, or mistakes I've made in the preparation and delivery of particular sermons." In closing his video, Lytton appealed to Southern Baptists to work together to address issues such as sexual abuse and racism, despite the polarized times they live in. "We must not fail to reckon with our past mistakes," he said. "We must commit to seeking for a better future where racism and prejudices are relics of the past, and our churches are safe places for survivors and welcoming and wanting people of all ethnicities." We'll wrap up this week on Religion in the News with another article from the Washington Post, this one published on February 27th, and it's entitled, "For Many Immunosuppressed, Churches Stopped Being a Safe Place." And this article is by Sarah Pulliam Bailey of the Washington Post. We'll have to edit this a bit for time. For centuries, Christians have met in sacred places that also provided safety for those seeking asylum, including runaway slaves and undocumented immigrants. But those same sanctuaries where many sing and embrace each other have become anxiety-inducing and possibly dangerous for many Americans who are considered higher risk for COVID-19. More than 7 million Americans have weakened immune systems that make them more vulnerable to contracting the coronavirus and can make COVID-19 more deadly. Many have chosen to stay home. Those who are immunocompromised include people with medical conditions that weaken their immune response, as well as people taking immune-suppressing drugs because of cancer, organ transplants, or autoimmune diseases. As states across the country are lifting COVID-19 precautions, such as mask mandates, and some churches have dropped online services, the immunocompromised are weighing their risk of possible exposure in worship services. And some are finding their fellow parishioners and church leaders aren't taking measures to protect them. Andrea Ramsey was attending a non-denominational church in D.C., where before the pandemic she was asked to speak in church about living with a chronic illness that prevents her from working. Ramsey has hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which causes problems with her immune system. Ramsey's church had formed small online groups during the early months of the pandemic that became a lifeline for her, but leaders stopped the groups in 2021 to encourage people to worship in person. "When they cut the home groups, it felt like, wait a minute, this place that cared for me and my situation was trying to move on without us," said Ramsey, who is 44. Her church initially required masks, but many would ignore the mandate. I've been in church situations where I'm accused of not having enough faith, she said. I never got that sense from this church. It was when we were a year and a half into things I was noticing we're not talking about vaccination from the pulpit. We're not enforcing mask mandates. She said other things led her to recently leave her church, but the way the leaders treated COVID-19 caused her to lose trust. They had a greeting time at a gathering and said, "Come on, you can hug each other. We don't need to be afraid," she said. That pissed me off. We don't need to be afraid, but we need to be careful. It was one of the incidents that cemented in my mind that it's not going to be a safe place for me. Those who are immunocompromised are not a monolith and experience different degrees of immunosuppression that could impact their response to the virus, said Deepta Bhattacharya, an immunologist at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Someone who has cancer like lymphoma and doesn't respond well to the coronavirus vaccine, for example, is likely at higher risk than someone on an immunosuppressive drug for something like Crohn's disease. Also, many circumstances have changed since the early days of the pandemic, Bhattacharya said. Vaccinations tend not to provide the same level of antibodies to someone who is immunosuppressed as they would for someone else, but they still reduce chances of the person getting sick or becoming seriously ill. High-quality masks like N95 masks, which are more effective than cloth ones, are more available. Doctors have access to newer treatments, though some have been in shorter supply. Many people who are immunosuppressed still choose to attend in-person services, including J. Maxie Sanchez, 19, who has been visiting Baptist and non-denominational churches in her new town of San Marcos, where she is a freshman at Texas State University. Sanchez has arthritis, fibromyalgia, and gastroparesis, and is on medicine that suppresses her immune system. Her rheumatologist, who is a Christian, hasn't discouraged her from attending services. Sanchez said that she used to wear a mask in church, but decided to stop because no one else would wear one, and the people she attends with are friends she spends time with during the week anyway. "If I wore a mask, people might think I was contagious or sick," she said. "I feel normal wearing a mask to school, but because people don't wear them to church, it feels a little weird." Others have stayed away from in-person services entirely. Tori Cross, 28, who has asthma and is on medication that makes her immunocompromised, said her pulmonologist cautioned her against attending services, so she hadn't gone in person since the pandemic started. Just 2 years before, she had found her ideal church. After exploring the Catholic tradition, she began attending an Episcopal church in San Francisco in 2018 that fit her progressive values. "I wanted a community that would hold my queerness. It felt very safe, like a place I could belong. I spent time in the AIDS Memorial Chapel thinking about queer ancestors," she said. "I never got to go back." Cross moved to D.C. in the summer of 2021, and with the district's mask mandate lifting soon, she's wary of finding a new church. "I've been too scared to try," she said. "Trying to make accommodations for everyone has been tricky," said John Sauer, pastor of a Presbyterian USA church in Simi Valley, California. Sauer says he understands what it's like for immunocompromised folks, since he has been on an immune-suppressing medication for rheumatoid arthritis since he was 18. His church follows local county guidelines, so the church will move to mask optional for those who are vaccinated soon, though he said he plans to continue holding an outdoor service through the pandemic. He wears a double KN95 mask and asks staff to wear masks so that someone in the back doesn't have to feel uncomfortable if they are the only ones doing so. "We have people who are attached to the sanctuary," he said. "Some people have been here 60 or 70 years. We try to make it as safe as possible so that they can be in that space." We've reached the end of our time for this week on Religion in the News. We thank you for tuning in and hope you'll join us again next time. I'm Brian LeBlanc, and this has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.